Welcome to this program recorded at the 1997 First International Public Conference on Vaccination, held September 13th through the 15th in Alexandria, Virginia. Any unauthorized use of the contents of this tape without the written consent of the authors is strictly prohibited. Our topics: vaccine regulation and polio vaccine contamination. Our presenter, Walter Kyle, followed by discussion, vaccines and chronic illness. This is tape number 6.
Our next speaker is Walter Kyle. He is an attorney in private practice specializing in vaccine product liability litigation, and he will speak on vaccine regulation and polio vaccine contamination. He holds degrees in mechanical and electrical engineering from University of Miami and received his law degree from University of Arkansas. An expert on the manufacturing of polio vaccines, his hypothesis that HIV developed in man after lots of live polio vaccine contaminated with simian immunodeficiency virus were released was published in The Lancet in 1992. Mr. Kyle.
Thank you. Now can you hear me? Howard, I think it's your government agents they're after me.
It doesn't do lawyers. Thank you. It's a plant, I can tell. When I started this 20 years ago, I had no intentions as an attorney of ever doing anything like this. The fact that I'm here today just is a tribute to the obstinance that I've met in the government and the pharmaceutical industry over the years, the refusal to admit that vaccines caused the problem from the very outset. And I think I should give you a little bit of the background and my involvement in it, and I'll try and evolve the story from my perspective as I saw it as a young attorney getting into this. Initially, I went to law school to become an aviation attorney. I flew all through law school, and that's all I wanted to do. I wanted to fly planes and do aviation law. However, I took one of my airplanes back to the airline that I'd worked for all through law school to have it repaired, and I was sitting there talking to the chief mechanic. We were in the hangar. I remembered he looked at me and he said, you want a chew of tobacco? I was in my mid-20s, and I hadn't chewed tobacco since I was 8. I was from Arkansas. This is something you didn't do post-puberty. But I did. I went ahead. I took the chew, and we were sitting there spitting the tobacco onto the floor. And he says, you know, I got a problem. And I said, what's that? And he said, my wife has polio. And I said, polio? This is 1977. How'd she get polio? He said, well, we sort of think she got it from the child. I said, how did that happen? I had no clue. And he said, we need to get an attorney. I wasn't admitted to the bar yet. It was the middle of August in 1977. But I said, I know what you need to do. I'll be your attorney. So what I did, we got the plane fixed. I flew to Little Rock. I got admitted to the bar early. I flew back that night. I rented a typewriter for 50 cents at the University of Arkansas Library. I typed up my first contingency fee contract, and I signed him up that day. And then I went back to Little Rock, and I got a good attorney to help me with a case. And it started out as a failure to warn case, that you, Letterly Laboratory, should have warned this woman that she could have gotten polio from the vaccine administered to her son. And that's the way the attorney that I associated in Little Rock wanted to catch the case. But as I got involved and deeper into it, I discovered that in fact what had happened, and this was from interviewing CDC officials, was that the government intended for that vaccine given to the child to spread to the mother and infect her with the polio vaccine and immunizer. It was an intended government program. And don't lose sight of that. What happens is the virus goes into the baby's mouth because it's an oral vaccine, comes out in the stool, it mutates inside the intestinal tract, and it becomes more virulent. In fact, we now know it reverts essentially to wild polio. This was 1977, and the state of the art was this. The doctor who had administered the vaccination to the child had no clue that the polio vaccine could cause polio in the child, much less the mother. At the same time this was going on, Letterly Laboratories was writing internal memorandums stating that one of the advantages of the vaccine was its ability to spread. The CDC, Dr. Sabin at this time, were still propounding the concept that there was absolutely nothing wrong with this vaccine, that possibly 1 in 8 to 10 million doses might result in an adverse reaction. Not then and not today in the package insert is it ever admitted that the polio vaccine can cause polio. If you read the package insert very carefully, it says it's associated with paralytic disease. Paralytic disease includes many different diseases, most of which are curable and result are short term. So, as I found out later, this was part of Dr. Sabin's contract with Letterly. They basically would never admit that this vaccine could cause polio. So, we took that case to trial. It interested me that this was a perfectly healthy woman for her whole life until she came down with this disease. She was categorized by CDC as having an immune deficiency. We had her blood tested. We got expert opinions. She was not immune deficient, but she had a transient immune deficiency. In fact, there were a series of cases noted that year in the New England Journal of Medicine of transient immune deficiencies associated with the polio vaccine. And I just put it in my file, and that was it. A couple years later, she was in church in Arkansas. She saw another woman that was paralyzed. They got to talking. That was my second case. She had never been diagnosed. I diagnosed her. I probably diagnosed more cases of polio than any practicing physician in the country today. truly, and I've seen it in a wide perspective. I've seen polio do things that are not even spoken about. I'm going to throw it out since I think that in the wild state, polio caused encephalitis in about 20% of the cases. And you should keep that in mind. That's a brain inflammation resulting in seizures and so forth. When I started doing DTP cases under the Vaccine Compensation Act, I started seeing cases where 3 weeks after the DTP polio shot, you started getting seizure activity, massive seizure activity. And in some of these cases, or one particular one, the parents had forged the records to show DPT. In fact, they had just received a DT shot. And so I saw encephalitis following the oral polio vaccine, just like you see in a wild state. Now, it's significant. Here's the government. You talk about Tuskegee. Don't forget the radiation experiments. Here's a government that has taken upon itself to immunize its population, a group of people, to expose them to this vaccine without their knowledge, consent, or free will. No information was given out at that time. There was nothing in the package insert. We settled the case with Letterly on the day of trial. The big issue was the immune deficiency. I went ahead then and filed suit on my own against the federal government, alleging two things. One, that the government failed to test the vaccine for safety. The vaccine never should have been licensed originally. And two, that it violated your right to privacy. It violated your constitutional right to privacy to be exposed to a vaccine without your knowledge or consent. Went to the Court of Appeals. Part of it was upheld. It was sent back. It was dismissed. We went to the Court of Appeals and came back and we went to trial. We ultimately settled that. Significantly, I found out several years later that this spread immunity they were talking about, especially considering the type 3 vaccine, was dealing with a vaccine which would revert back to wild polio within 2 or 3 days of administration. The most recent case I did, there was an affidavit submitted from Dr. Thomas Weller. Dr. Kinsmore was helping me. Dr. Thomas Weller, who is one of the 3 Nobel laureates that received the polio, the Nobel for the discovery that polio could be grown out in monkey cells, submitted an affidavit on behalf of Letterly Wyeth that essentially stated you can't make this vaccine safe. It's going to revert back to wild polio within a few days, So it's not a manufacturing defect, so they ought not to be liable. That was their conclusion. And that's what we're faced with. By 1979, the genetic testing had come out to pretty much conclusively show that polio vaccine was causing polio. It was irrefutable at that time. They couldn't get around it. I continued to do cases on and off. And I guess it was in the, I'm going to go to my notes here for just a second. In the early 80s, we started seeing cases of AIDS break out. And I thought in my mind, even at that time, I said, I wonder if something in that polio vaccine caused the immune deficiency, caused her to be paralyzed, versus it was her immune system that was at fault. The drug company, of course, tried to assert that it was the person's immune system that was at fault. So I sent this hypothesis. I was working at that time with Jonas Salk. He would help me out. I met him. I met his son. We were on a first-name basis. I traveled out to La Jolla and went through his institute. He was very helpful in anything I needed. He and Dr. Sabin did not get along one bit. They didn't like each other. Salk thought his vaccine was excellent, and he thought Sabin's vaccine was always improperly licensed because it caused polio, and nobody would talk about it. The CDC wouldn't talk about it, and never would admit up until that time that it would cause polio. What Dr. Salk didn't tell me, what I discovered later, that his vaccine wasn't much better. And the problems with Dr. Salk's vaccine essentially caused it to come off the market. And this brings me to a point that I haven't revealed before, but I know that Dr. Salk's vaccine was then retested in the mid-70s in Africa. And that point hasn't been brought up because it sort of comes into this whole African experience that I'm going to get into momentarily. I want to backtrack just a second on because you need to know this in a background on polio. Polio came out in industrialized nations after the nations became sanitized. People would wash their hands after they went to the bathroom and so forth, so there was no spread of polio. And kids would grow up without ever being exposed to polio, and they would get it when they were a little older. They wouldn't have the maternal antibodies then, and they would become paralyzed. It started as an industrialized nation's problem. And I think Sweden or the more advanced nations in cleanliness were the first ones to get hit with it, and that followed a pattern through the United States. The reason I mention that is because it directly ultimately correlates to the way vaccine policy was instituted in this country. Do any of you know why your children are getting their DTP shots when they're 2 months old? Do you know why 2 months was picked? Well, why is it the first well visit? The reason that 2 months was picked is because the maternal antibodies to polio drop off at 2.5 to 3 months. After the oral Sabin vaccine was introduced and it was discovered that the vaccine wasn't safe, the government instituted this program to get the vaccine to the kids while they were still not susceptible to it. So the safety record of the vaccine is predicated upon the fact that you're administering that first shot to kids that are already immune to polio from the maternal antibodies. So while you got them in there, you give them DTP. Now, we've changed vaccine policy in this country. You're no longer given the oral vaccine at 2 months. There's no need to give DTP at 2 months. You, I think, should wait till after the neurological system becomes intact, post 2 years, like the Japanese do, and give any administrations then, or see if you can get out of doing it at all, depending on what your preference is. But it all ties in. This immunization schedule ties into polio and the improper licensing of the original polio vaccine. The government was found at fault, found negligent for licensing this vaccine, the oral polio vaccine, the only vaccine that the government's ever been sued on and found negligent for licensing, or not licensing, but for releasing. It's an important factor in this whole equation. The as I stated, the government didn't want to admit that the vaccines could cause any problems. And I've seen it. I had another case. I had a woman in Massachusetts whose child had died 4 or 5 days after receiving DTP polio. The child had polio in its brain. It had polio in its heart. It had polio in its liver. It had a stack of laboratory records that high identifying the polio as vaccine polio, and not one single doctor in the state of Massachusetts or in Canada where the other or the research was done would admit that the polio vaccine caused that child's death. And not only would they not diagnose it as a polio death, they wouldn't give the mother the records. She ended up coming down and talking at a conference at the Institute of Medicine in 92. I took the case under the Vaccine Act, and the government conceded it was death caused by polio right off the bat. It was the first conceded death case with polio, I think, in history. And with that, the mother was able to go back and change the birth certificate. I know that sort of seems like a disjointed point. But when the police came out to investigate the child's death, they told the mother if she ever had another child die, that they would prosecute her for murder in that case. So it was significant to her to have the death certificate changed. This was the government's attitude and the medical establishment's attitude through 1992. I give you these cases because here today you've seen a lot of research, theoretical, you know, logical scientific hypothesis. It's good research, it's good work, but you're facing a group of people in the government that you're never going to be able to overcome. I'll tell you, if a kid dies with a needle in its arm, with a DTP vaccine in it, and the CDC official sitting right next to him, they're going to say, you know, I think it's the electromagnetic waves in that power station next door. We've got to look into that first, too. It's incredible the response you get from the very obvious. The thing that needs to be changed is at the upper levels, upper echelons of the NIH. The people that have been there that were responsible for this polio program, starting with Dr. Ruth Kirkstein, just to give you a couple of initials, should be removed. Should be removed from their office, and people should be put in place that will honestly investigate what's going on. And I say Dr. Kirkstein, a lot of you don't know who she is, but her name is throughout the polio history. She has suppressed information on vaccine reactions from 1965. She admitted it to scientific conventions in Hamburg, Germany. She found out that a reporter was present. She had the reporter stopped. They took his notes. They changed the transcript. And she testified contrary to what she said at the conference. She testified in legal cases contrary to what she said at the conference. Dr. Kirkstein happens to now be the official in charge of the investigation into the SV40. And I told Barbara Fisher, I told her when she told me there was an SV40 conference and I went to it, I said, what's going on? She said, well, Dr. Kirkstein's going to be in charge. You remember Dr. Kirkstein? She was a temporarily the head of the NIH. Oh, NIH, yeah, not invented here. And she was there at the opening of that ceremony of the SV40 conference in January, and at the very conclusion, all the data was turned back over to her. I can tell you that the conclusions of that conference I heard in the elevator coming down the stairs the next morning. You don't need to hold your breath anymore. I mean, there's not going to be any association with SV40 and the cancers found by our government. But now that I'm talking about SV40, let's go back to what happened in Africa. and what happened in my research and what I've seen and found. The like I said, my initial question was whether or not the immune deficiency in my original case might have been something in the polio vaccine. SV40 is a simian virus. 40 is just a monkey virus that was discovered in the late 50s by Dr. Bernice Eddy, who is a researcher who just took monkey tissue and injected it into hamsters. And this was the same monkey tissue being used to make the vaccine. Now, this is rhesus monkey tissue. Rhesus monkey tissue that was being used to make the vaccines, they later found out in that time period, was 100% contaminated with SV40. So, there was a big conference in Washington. What are we going to do? We got hamsters dying. No one's going to admit this can be associated with human cancers. The memos indicate that, you know, you're going to need more than 20 years of follow-up. So it was decided to be done, and I have the transcript of the record. At the meeting was Dr. Joseph Melnick, Albert Sabin, Smadel from England, several others, Roderick Murray from the United States. Roderick Murray from the United States, who headed it, he was the director of Bureau of Biologics at the time, stood up in front of this group of scientists and told them that there was no question in his mind that the SV40 was in the inactivated vaccines. 6 months later, he testified before Congress that it was conclusively known that there was no SV40 in the Salk vaccines. But they did change their policy. What they did was they had a conference and they decided to switch monkeys. And the reason they decided to switch monkeys was because the SV40 and the rhesus monkeys couldn't really be detected easily. The way they were tested monkeys is they would take them and quarantine them for 6 weeks. If the monkey didn't get sick, they could use the monkey. And SV40 didn't make those monkeys sick. So what do? They switched them to African green monkeys. Not a good choice. Albert Sabin even pointed out, we don't have any experience with these monkeys. We don't know what's in them. Maybe there's a virus in those monkeys that doesn't make them sick that could make humans sick. Well, I can only say that the AIDS epidemic did one thing. The discovery of HIV did one thing. It had enabled our government scientists and researchers funded by the NIH to discover simian immunodeficiency virus in the African green monkeys by using cross-reactivity tests from the HIV. They didn't discover that the monkeys they had been using for 30 years were contaminated with a simian virus, which did not make that monkey sick. Made rhesus monkeys sick, probably made chimps sick. And it was incredible to me, and I was incredulous when I started getting into these facts, and I saw in my notes a series of memorandums, government memorandums, which documented as early as 1968 that the government knew that there were monkey viruses going out in the vaccines, and they didn't care. The reason they didn't care is because they felt there was no way that monkey viruses could cross from simians to humans. Dr. Valancourt, Ronald Valancourt, the head of biological production at Letterly for 15 years, testified before me and others that they knew that simian viruses were going out in the oral polio vaccine. They don't admit it anymore, but this is what has been said in the past. And I didn't actually ask Dr. Valancourt that question until 1990. What I did was I started gathering evidence. I started to see the documents. The Marburg virus came out in 1968. Marburg killed a bunch of polio workers in Germany. There were meetings at NIH. What are we going to do about this? You know, well, we got a quarantine period. It'll kill the monkeys, and there's nothing else there. In the early 1990s, I put all my thoughts together. After suing the government under the Freedom of Information Act, I came to the conclusion that one particular monopool of polio vaccine, which I had identified, a lot 3-444, had been contaminated with something.
It had been contaminated, apparently, with what was then referred to as a type C retrovirus. Now, from a historical perspective, if you read Len Horowitz's book, who's here today, did a great job on this. Originally, HIV was considered the first human retrovirus. It was considered to be a type C virus then, and SIV, when it was first identified, was considered to be a type C virus. They've been later reclassified. So when I say type C, we're talking about mid-70s. They found a Bonopool, a vaccine that had an unknown virus in it. The government tested that vaccine for almost 2 years. They took the virus, they made electron microscope pictures of it, which I have copies of. They actually sent them to me. They actually sent me the analysis of electron micrographs. In the analysis of all the photographs of this virus, they stated under oath, Dr. John Petrucciani gave an affidavit that this virus didn't appear to be any of the known retroviruses, or any of the known viruses. They didn't know what it was, but they could say with certainty it was not any of the known viruses. Three memos state that. The three memos were directed to Dr. John Martin, who was ahead of the project at the time. I've talked to Dr. Martin about this. The fact is that they were given sort of a directive. If this is not any of the known viruses, then it meets the regulations. The vaccine can be released unless there is something in it that is known to be harmful to man. And since we don't know what this is, it's not known to be harmful to man, so it can be released. And it was. What the laboratory people did not have, what the government refused to give me, even though I sued them and they filed affidavits in federal court in Boston that they'd given me everything about this vaccine, was the laboratory data. I got the laboratory data someplace else. The laboratory data is entitled Cell Culture Assays for Adventitious Virus in Polio Vaccine. And it describes this as a type C retrovirus. They didn't know what it was, and they transferred it to three different cell lines. In other words, it was infectious for human embryonic lung tissue, rhesus lung tissue, and African green lung tissue. Petrucciani submitted an affidavit from the Bureau of Biologics, he was then at the World Health Organization, that this sort of information didn't exist and they didn't do those tests. After you deal with these people a while and you see how they lie and misrepresent, you come to the conclusion that they shouldn't be in charge of the program, that they should be removed. My personal feeling is that Dr. Kirkstein should be removed, and everyone in her family and all of their friends ought to be taken out of NIH. And if you know Dr. Kirkstein and her family and her friends, includes a large group of people over there. It's a sad commentary that after all these years, Dr. Kirkstein has wrangled her way back in to overseeing the SV40 investigation. This is going to be nothing but a whitewash. It's going to be a whitewash that she's experienced in doing, and she's experienced in it over 30 years. And it can be shown, because in Hamburg in 1965, the representatives from Lederle, Wyeth, and Pfizer just happened to write memos about what Dr. Kirkstein said. And we've got them in discovery. So we know what she said. So the fact that she altered the transcript then doesn't let her off the hook now. You know, we're faced with a situation now. We're still making our vaccine, our oral polio vaccine, in this African green monkey tissue. I don't think anybody else is doing that. And the reason most other countries aren't doing it is because they recognize the problem with it. I'm going to talk briefly about my Lancet article. As Dr. Ernovitz likes to introduce me, I've published more articles in The Lancet than he has. The overview of it is this. And I thought it was an interesting thought anyway. Of course, I was the one that wrote it, so I'm entitled to think it's interesting. Other people may find it boring, but it all made sense to me. Here's what I proposed in general. I proposed that a vaccine, which is given to every child in this country and all over the world, resulted in the AIDS epidemic without ever affecting, obviously, the kids that it was given to. I mean, this is such a bizarre hypothesis, you couldn't get it published in the Globe or the Star. Really, it is. That's why I went to the leading medical journal in the world. I say leading medical journal because Science wouldn't take it, and I didn't even bother going to the New England Journal of Medicine because I knew what their answer would be. And it goes something like this. You remember the woman changing her diapers whose child was passed the stool and she got the virus in her hands and she became paralyzed by it? The child wasn't harmed. Typically, you know, one of the cues on HIV is you can kiss someone with AIDS, you won't get AIDS. Gastrointestinal, you know, you don't get AIDS from kissing somebody with it, usually. It's possible, but usually you don't. That's what you've been told from the very beginning. There's only one type of homosexual sex that results in that. The lesbian community didn't experience. So think about it just a second. Here you've got a vaccine, it's contaminated with a monkey virus in it. And in the mid-70s, a big problem in this country was genital herpes. Now, some wise physician came up with the idea that we're going to treat the herpes with oral polio vaccine. And they used it. It's published and cited my article, but in the mid-70s, the only treatment for herpes was the live oral polio vaccine. So now, but it's not just the vaccine in one dose, it's multiple doses, and it apparently cleared it up. And doctors in Berkeley, California wrote a nice little letter saying what a wonderful treatment this is. And it was published all over the United States to dermatologists. So now you have dermatologists giving the oral vaccine, thinking it's absolutely safe and giving it in multiple doses. And it's going through the intestines, and the sexual activity is directly correlated. The people were therefore exposed to that virus through their acts. Not a politically correct thing to say, and I apologize if I offend anybody from it, but it just seemed to make sense to me. And it made enough sense that The Lancet published it. And the tripe that I've heard in response to that is so bizarre. The medical community came up with several different things. They said, oh, it couldn't be that virus. That's too far genetically apart from that African green monkey virus. It's too far genetically apart from the human immunodeficiency virus. It couldn't be the same. That's nonsense. It's a retrovirus. And now we don't even refer to them as SIV and HIV anymore. They're so similar, they call it primate immunodeficiency virus. And when it's in the body now, the latest virology records show that it is in what's known as a quasi-species. It recombines so erratically that it can adapt to any host that it's in. I also hypothesized in The Lancet, actually they didn't publish it, that sporadically you might see some of this HIV come out in kids who had received the vaccine and for some reason had a lesion or something and it got into their system. And you would have cases of AIDS in children or others that had no known risk factors. And certainly, if you're familiar with the Whitney Williams case and 900 other cases that the government has followed, there's a substantial number of cases which are just like that. No known risk factors, and people have AIDS. And you trace it back, like Whitney Williams, you trace it back to a vaccine. She was immunized in a year before, I think 1982, before they started testing for the SIV and the vaccine. It's a simple theory. Well, it's sort of complex. And it's sort of simple, but like I say, it made sense into the scientific community. On the other hand, the vaccines in Africa were apparently made from the rhesus monkeys. They were not made in the African green. The rhesus monkey does not have SIV in it normally, which is, you know, my counter contention to what Howard put up about the origination of AIDS in Africa. There was no AIDS found. I don't think there's been a documented case of AIDS prior to the mid-1970s anyway. And that brings me back to Jonas Salk. When I sent him this theory, he sent me back a nice letter. He said, I'm too busy worrying about how to cure this than to worry about where it came from. And I thought to myself, Jiminy Crow, that's not what I expected from you, Jonas. I thought you'd leap on a chance to, you know, to beat Albert to death. But that's not what I got. And then I just, I remembered later that in the mid-1970s, I called him once. He was headed to Moreau to go to Africa. They were testing his new inactivated vaccine made in African green monkey cells in Africa. And maybe, you know, someday if we get all the data, we'll put it together. But we'll never get all the data unless we get rid of the people that are the head of the NIH in Washington now and put some people in that are sympathetic to the people that pay their bills.
Now, can you hear me? Okay. Thank you very much, Walter. We are going to now take a 15-minute break, which would put us at 4 o'clock, I believe. Is that what time we would be coming back? 4 o'clock. And then we will have a half-hour discussion period with the three most recent speakers.
There are also tapes now available of every speaker you've heard up to this point that you can purchase out here at the repeat performance table.
All right, could we please have our first question?
Okay, I also wanted to mention that tomorrow evening we're also having an open interactive forum for about an hour starting at 7 o'clock. And some of the more philosophical questions that got brought up this morning, that would be a very appropriate time for you to discuss them.
Hi. My name is Dr. Christine Severin. I'm Director of Ohio Parents for Vaccine Safety. I want to congratulate NVIC for organizing this wonderful conference. I've been in Washington, D.C. all this week attending government vaccine policymaking commission meetings. And also, I publish a national newsletter where I let you know what the government is up to within this area. A couple of issues came up. They want to vaccinate all adults with pertussis vaccine, the AIDS vaccine for all babies, and venereal disease vaccines for all 11 and 12-year-olds so that they can sleep around with no fear of VD or little fear of VD. The head of vaccination immunization for the CDC acknowledged on more than one occasion that vaccine safety has such low priority at the CDC that they do not have enough money to fund it. And they don't fund it. They fund it very little. And the criteria by which vaccine victims are compensated, that is the vaccine injury table, is being made smaller and smaller all the time. Anybody who's interested, I have business cards. You can contact me. I guess this was sort of like for Dr. Ernovitz, is that going to all these meetings, and I've been doing this for several years, you know, I just sit and smile when I'm listening to all of this, and there is a lot of corruption, and they do say things at these meetings that aren't in all of the glitzy public relations material that they give out to the public. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. You sit back and smile. I used to have a full head of hair.
Barbara Alexander Malarkey from Illinois. I'm just curious as to what you think about the ingredients in vaccines. Kyle, okay, sorry, Walter. Monkey virus, guinea pig cells, chicken embryo, fetal bovine serum, and the latest, I mean, among other things that I heard about from the president of the vaccine division of Merck, is that MSG, monosodium glutamate, is in all of the viral vaccines, and he was pretty positive that it was in all of the bacterial vaccines. When I asked him why, he said that MSG has to be in those vaccines, otherwise the virus would die. When I told him that some people in the United States have problems with MSG, he said, well, they have to use it. And I said, well, why is it that I just see it on your data for the chickenpox vaccine and I see it on no other package insert? He said, well, that's because it's in the culture medium and we don't have to list it. So my question is, not only are the things that you're talking about, you know, in the package insert and are a problem, but what about these things we don't know? And what about cross species? I don't understand how we can put fetal bovine serum and all of that into human beings. Antoine Béchamp, back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, said, when we cross species, we are setting up trouble. So is that what the big problem here is?
Yes, I think so. I mean, of course, that's what a lot of my work's directed to, is the problem with cross-species transmission. There was an assumption made at NIH in the early 50s, maybe 60s. It's been written about, American Society of Microbiology wrote about it last year, that actually concerning the development of the field of microbiology, there was a basic assumption made that in many cases, cross-species transmission of diseases could not occur. There was a species barrier, I think is what they called it. You're familiar with that? And this was just something that they felt comfortable with, that everyone accepted. And I think it's pretty much conclusively shown now that there's no such thing as a species barrier. You look at the horse measles that killed the people in Australia a year or so ago. Is an example, and look at all the other diseases. Syphilis, for example, and I'm sure Howard, whose expertise in this is greater than mine, could. So the assumption's been made that it's very safe, or it's safe, there's no problem, just as the CDC tells us that there is no risk from vaccines, so therefore there is no, risk-benefit, the risk-benefit equation is all benefit. It's just, as I say, totally false. I've said before, and I'll conclude on this, is that I think it's entirely unethical for the agency in charge of ensuring, under the statute, ensuring the safety of vaccines and biologicals is also undertaken on its own to promote them. You cannot regulate their safety and promote them at the same time ethically, and that's why I'm calling for a removal of the people at the top and a removal of their family and their friends.
Please stop this tape at this point and continue listening on side B.
Just to address that last comment on cross-species disease transmission, most biological warfare agents come from veterinary diseases. I mean, it's very common for rabbit fever, for example, tularemia comes from rabbits, anthrax comes from cattle. I mean, the notion that diseases can't transmit cross species is totally ridiculous.
Hi, my name is Courtney Parks. I'm from Port Royal, Pennsylvania. This question is for either Dr. Ernovitz or Mr. Toot. I have a brother who's 34. He received a DT vaccination 2 years ago, which was required for graduate school. He has a severe vascular condition. He recently had two open heart surgeries last August, so he's really suffered greatly over the past 2 years. And my question is, I don't really hear so much about negative reactions to DT. I normally hear it in relation to DPT, so I had a question about, is it fairly rare that there's that type of reaction, and if so, is it difficult to have some type of compensation? And my second question is, since typically a lot of the research or that I've been exposed to is based on children, are there different guidelines for administration or reactions in adults versus children?
I'm going to answer, I think Walter should also, and Jimmy Fontu. I think the bottom line is I don't know of any medical information, and where now you can go two ways down this fork is, if I was working for the government, I'd say I don't know of any information, therefore it doesn't exist. I want to go down a different fork, being from Berkeley, is that I don't know of this information because I think no one's keeping records on it. And our whole problem to date is no one's, we had to, let me give you an example. We have to discuss openly with our colleagues things like there were no records kept. So therefore, it's ignoble of myself to say that Burkitt's lymphoma first appeared in 1958, the first published paper on it, because it could have been there before, but no one recorded it. I don't know. I've been to Africa. They're very bright people there. I think they'd know a football-sized tumor on your lip when they saw one. And so I think this whole issue boils down to that if you don't have records, no one's going to believe it. First of all, it would be hard for me to comment on your brother's case. It's probably multifactorial origin. It may or may not be related to that, and that's just something we have to do. But I don't know of anybody keeping records unless somebody else does. So, again, if we don't know, how do we answer?
You go ahead.
Many of these toxoid vaccines do carry warnings that they can cause central nervous system damage or can result in central nervous system response, and it's one of the warnings that they carry with them, including the diphtheria toxoid vaccine. Now, I'm not aware of any common reaction, but that doesn't mean that this reaction can occur, and in fact, if you just pick up the physician's desk reference, you'll see that this is a warning or a contraindication that it is carried on many of these vaccines, especially the toxoids.
Would it be nice if NVIC kept the physician's report to them?
Would it be nice if they were well funded?
Yes.
My name is Kathy Rothschild, and I'm from Chicago. I got involved in this issue because the Department of Health in Illinois requires now that all 10-year-olds and 5-year-olds have a series of three hepatitis B vaccinations. And and I might add that this decision was made without the consent of the legislature. It was never a law. It was never passed or signed by the governor. But at any rate, there's one, and I want to address my question to Dr. Ernovitz. There's one reaction that hasn't been discussed yet regarding hepatitis B, and in the package insert, it says that although tests have not been completed regarding the long-term effects of the vaccine, it may affect reproductive capacity. And this is something that really has not been discussed yet. This was brought up at the hearings in Illinois, and even the director of the Department of Health would not answer my question about this. And I also want to know if any of you know what exactly is in the hepatitis B vaccination that could affect reproductive capacity.
Do you know which one? There is a recombinant protein, and Chicago is interesting area because that's where it's made. Are you talking about a live virus hepatitis, or are you talking about the recombinant protein?
I'm sure it's the recombinant version.
The recombinant protein. Yeah, I guess the question that was addressed this morning was when some people got a second shot of measles and they started coming down with the SSPE and what have you, is what is the value of giving somebody hepatitis B when they may in fact have a chronic latent form of hepatitis B? And I think the only thing I can answer is, again, unless we have some studies in this area, is because if it claims that, I think it's just using words that basically say if it's going to ruin some reproductive abilities, it's a nice way of saying you're screwed if you take this vaccine. So until you start doing the research on what does it mean to give somebody a vaccine to something they've already got in their body and to start doing those studies, then that's the only way we'll really get at the root of these types of questions.
My name is Maria Hidalgo Dolan. I'm from Wall Township, New Jersey. I invite anyone from New Jersey to sit together for dinner tonight at the banquet. And then I want to ask Mr. Kyle, you mentioned something about breastfeeding. In my past life, I was an attorney, and then I became a mother, and then I started breastfeeding, and then I became an Alleged League leader. And in some of our materials, which, of course, the Alleged League won't touch anything controversial, there is information about the fact that in the 1950s, when mothers, and there was a decline in breastfeeding, that's when the oral polio was given, that there was an increase in the polio of the children. And I didn't hear about the mothers, but I did hear about the actual children. And I wondered if either any one of the three of you could speak to that.
Well, that would be consistent with what I was commenting on, that you lose maternal antibodies after a couple of months. Whether or not that's, and I don't recall from the study whether that is as a result of breastfeeding or without. That was a general statistic, to the best of my recollection. I would assume, from my layman's knowledge of breastfeeding, that if you breastfed, you would continue to provide the antibodies to the child, and therefore you would continue the immunity for some period. I get it. Somebody shaking his head. Dr. Fuden.
Antibodies destroyed by the acid, an enzyme in the stomach, what does that do, though, or some meters of Grandmothers,
great grandmothers, and girls, for years, they've given infants colostrum, goat's calf, and colostrum dry for the first
3 days after delivery with the calf. Mm-hmm. He said the colostrum, which you get in the first couple of days of life, does provide that. But some of the immunities in breast milk are lost in the stomach.
Yeah. Just to address this, the studies on antibody are mostly looking at different classes of antibody. One's called an IgA, one's called IgG. You get the IgG from mother through the placenta, through the cord, and the IgA you get, and probably a little bit of IgG from breast milk. So hopefully that the IgA you get from the breast milk will line the gut, be absorbed in the gut, and be protective there. That's still no reason to make your vaccine policy 2 months, because that's when the mother goes down. It's just an observation.
Hi, my name is Debbie Alt, and I've been recruited by a couple of moms that I've traveled with from the Metropolitan New York Avenue area to ask a couple of questions. We're concerned about the aspects of unvaccinated children in terms of the shedding that we talked about earlier, as well as decisions as to when to go overseas or not, not necessarily in the typically troublesome areas, maybe the Caribbean. So the first part of that question would be about the shedding. What would you consider, how would you address the issue of the risk factor of children that are not vaccinated in being in small areas like pools or small preschool areas of kids that have been vaccinated, particularly with the oral vaccine?
He's a lawyer, I'll let him.
The shedding is a problem. This is something I've told, you know, clients for years. With the oral vaccine, as long as it's being used, you need to think about that as an issue. And, you know, that's why I recommended that you use IPV as long as the OPV is being used out there. Because although there's no longer any risk from wild polio, there's a risk from the vaccine. Something that wasn't mentioned today was in 1983, France switched from a combined regime of oral vaccine and injected vaccine as a matter of choice, and switched their whole program to injected vaccine, and thereby eliminated all polio in their country. So, you know, if you're concerned about it, the thing to do is use injected vaccine, and if you're real concerned about it, don't use anything that's made in the United or distributed in the United States. Get the Canadian vaccine made in diploid tissues instead of the green monkey tissues as we get here.
Well, and also the question of how would you address the question of going overseas to the Caribbean? Do you consider that less risky than some other troublesome areas? Would that be something
It's certainly less risky. I think all the polio in North America has been eliminated. I don't think there's been a reported case of polio in North America for 5 or 6 years.
Got other things to worry about. Don't drink the water.
I stick with a rum.
Okay. So you're pretty, so would the three panelists agree that you're comfortable with the best case scenario for protecting children from shedding would be to give them the killed polio virus vaccine?
As long as it's made in Canada from human cells.
Yeah, that's what I would say. If you want to protect them from shedding, give them the IPV, which has been the recommendation, sort of the recommendation for adults that are susceptible for years. You know, if you were a parent giving your child the live vaccine, you might have been better off taking the IPV yourself, and that would have protected you.
That's what I did for my child.
Which I guess is the best endorsement I can give to the
end. And I've traveled to Africa. I will take the dead vaccine because polio is a problem there. But, you know, you go there, there's tsetse flies, there's all kinds of stuff. And Montezuma is a personal friend of mine. And but, you know, look, you're taking kids traveling. Caribbean, check the health reports there, see the various area. You know, when you travel, you know, you're at risk. You know, you don't know if your driver's drunk on Prozac and whatever. But traveling's a problem. And you just have to realize that you're at risk for lots of things.
Shigellosis is probably a much greater risk than...
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Hi, I'm Teresa Kerr from Rochester, New York, and I just want to say this was a good conference, and I commend you all for coming and speaking. You were entertaining and enlightening. my question is for Dr. Howard Ernovitz. I wrote down because I didn't want to forget it. Is it possible that other pre-existing genetic conditions involving a connective tissue disorder be related to adverse reactions from vaccines and predispose an individual to autism?
Let me answer it this way, because of time, and I can't give you everything I know because I wouldn't have a job, is there's lots of other factors going on. We're finding out this whole area of DME, drug metabolizing enzymes. It turns out that certain races of individuals will metabolize things differently. Let's look at the Japanese race. They have a cytochrome 450 system. It's most unique. They smoke like chimneys, and they have the lower incidence of lung cancer. It's disproportional. And several papers now addressed a very interesting thing. When they smoke and the carcinogens get into the cell, the cytochrome 450 system doesn't oxygenate it. Therefore, it doesn't go to the nucleus. So you've got a lot of other factors being played here that some drugs in some situations won't make it. Well, let's take the case of sarin and soman. Some individuals have enzymes, peroxidase system, where at low levels you can completely inactivate sarin. But some people don't have that amino acid switch. So you've got that little factor about, Johnny didn't come down with it, but Billy did. You've got the problem of enzymes working with some in some people's systems that have evolved, that word again, with time so that they can detoxify certain food substances. Because let's face it, we evolved by eating food. And, let's face it, a lot of us evolved by going away from signs that say raw hamburger. The problem is we have to learn a system so that we can detoxify food and continue to get sources of carbohydrate, nitrogen, and what have you. So across the board, then, it's hard to do population studies if you have a mixed population like America. When you go into mixed connective tissue diseases, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, all these things, these are so many multifactorial diseases that we're going to have to pick apart every one of them. Using the flag, we're not looking for the one cause. We're looking for what the interactions is. And then from a treatment standpoint, going after the weakest link in that interaction. That makes good medical sense.
Okay. Hi, I'm Mary Toko. I'm a parent of 5 unvaccinated children. I'm also a co-director of Michigan Opposing Mandatory Vaccines. And my question, I have 2 of them. One is for James Tuitt. This is about the Gulf War syndrome. I understand through my reading that these soldiers were not disclosed what was being injected into them, and also that they were told they were not allowed to waive this. And I believe that's against the Nuremberg Code. Maybe you can address this. And if our kids are supposed to be out there fighting for our country, how can we even trust them to the government when our government is doing this to them?
There are several issues there. One is that, in fact, the soldiers are very rarely told what they're getting. They're just put into a line and, they just get the shots. And in fact, in most cases, they don't know what they're being injected with, except to look at their shot cards after the fact. Now, there were 2 vaccines that the veterans were given and 1 chemoprophylaxis for which the government had to go to the FDA and get a waiver of informed consent in order to administer them. Not only that, and these were the anthrax vaccine, I'm sorry, not the anthrax vaccine, the botulinum toxoid vaccine and the pyridostigmine bromide pills being used as an anti-nerve agent pretreatment. The anthrax wasn't approved vaccine. The anthrax vaccine and the botulinum toxoid vaccine were classified during the administration process, and that's one of the reasons why they got a waiver of informed consent. The reason it was classified was because they didn't want anybody to know what our soldiers were or were not protected against. Now, that having been said, once these soldiers got sick, they were very slow to come forward with the information about what these soldiers were immunized for. And more importantly, many of these soldiers never had their shot records returned, so they can't reconstruct what they were immunized for. Is it a violation of the Nuremberg Code? I don't know. They went to the FDA prior to giving these immunizations and actually got the FDA to waive the requirement for informed consent. Was it moral and ethical what was done? No, not at all.
We are going to need to close this discussion down. We can have 2 more short questions.
Okay, I'll keep it brief. I'm Dr. Weil from Richmond, Virginia. I'm a chiropractor, and his questions are directed to Mr. Kyle. First, I wasn't sure if you had stated or implied that you felt that the HIV was carried as SIV in the polio vaccine through the children, and that possibly it was transmitted to the adult population as polio was through the shedding. And number 2, in the case of shedding, are you only at risk if you come in direct contact with the feces, or is it just anyone near a child that's been vaccinated?
Taking the second question first, you have to have a direct contact with a child. Typically, you're going to have to, for example, there was a case of a grandfather that never changed the diapers of the child, but the child dribbled saliva onto his hand in the active stage, and on the cut, I guess, he had on his hand, he was paralyzed from that.
I would assume that when it's in its initial incubation stage, when it's in the pharynx, it can be transmitted, you know, aerosol fashion if you cough, just like pertussis can. In the article that I wrote in Lancet dealing with the shedding issue comes into play in a couple different ways. My suggestion in the Lancet was and is that the administration of the oral vaccine in multiple doses to male homosexuals for the treatment of genital herpes, and as you know now, herpes is a trigger for HIV. One of the factors, some people with HIV without herpes don't have AIDS, a curious phenomenon, that the sexual practices that these people engaged in, coupled with the fact that you have the vaccine and the monkey virus, and it doesn't necessarily have to be the monkey virus, it can be a component of it, genetic material, you know, enough to reform itself when it passes through, is where the epidemic originated. Whether it was the whole, you know, you asked, was it SIV, was it HIV, as I wrote, it was probably the progenitor of them. I thought that it was important and significant to go and find that particular vaccine and isolate the progenitor, because from it, if you saw the movie Outbreak, the whole movie Outbreak was predicated on the theory, you got to find that monkey, you find that monkey, you can get the virus, you get the original virus, you can cure it. And that's where I was coming from. I mean, it's a simple storyline. I've identified the lot. 5 years ago, I identified the lot. There are actually others. I mean, I didn't identify, I by no means disclose everything I know. I haven't disclosed all the evidence or the information. But I have identified one lot. And in 5 years, I have seen no data, no testing done on that lot. All they have to do is go pull it out of the storeroom, test it, publish it. Walter Kyle's wrong. You know, here's a lot, there's nothing in it. I mean, if I were a responsible government scientist and I had somebody to make a valid point in a leading medical journal, that's what I would have done. If they could have proven me to be wrong, I'm sure they would have done it by now. They haven't done it.
You know, you get a lot of, if I can just add on to that, you get a lot of information by reading package inserts. You get a lot of non-information. The most interesting thing to note while I was sitting there listening to the government tell me why the urine test is going to take another 3 years and $60 million to get out, and I was fortunate to sit in the section before me where there was a gentleman from France who was involved in AIDS research, and he was astonished that the discussion was why 15 to 20% of Americans are indeterminate for the HIV one blot. Let me say that again. In France, if you take blood, if you can get it from them, and put it on a Western blot for HIV-1, the definitive test, it's clean 99% of the time. You take 100 taxpaying, over-taxpaying Americans, and you find out that 15 to 20 of those will have antibodies to HIV-1 bands. But because it's not all the bands, it's not HIV-1. This lends a lot of credibility to what Walter was the original person to discover, was there was probably some retroviruses in those preps. And what we're seeing now is a lot of cross-reactivity, that 15 to 20% of this country has indeterminate bands. Now, this is public, but no one discusses this. I think that's outrageous.
This is our last question.
My name is Anna Marie Colvin. I'm from New York. I'd like to thank all the presenters so far. It's been absolutely mind-boggling. I have a question for Dr. Kyle. The government estimates that about 9 to 11 people a year get vaccine-associated paralytic polio. Is your estimate any different from that?
Well,
I have a letter from the government. It was August of 1982. I sent some vaccine records to the CDC. Again, this was a case of polio. This was the second case of polio. I sent the lady's vaccine records to CDC. I said, I think this woman has polio. I got a letter back. It says, CDC has classified this as a vaccine-associated case of polio type 2. And so I went to CDC to depose the doctor and get this into evidence. I got the doctor on the stand and ask him the question, well, how has CDC classified this case? And he said, we decided not to classify it. I said, what? He said, yeah, we decided not to classify it. And I said, why? And the government attorney interjected, and she says, I object. can't answer that question because there were government attorneys present in the meeting. And it's attorney-client privilege. I said, well, this is incredible. I've got this letter from you saying that it was vaccine-associated polio. And he said, yes, you do have that letter. And I said, did you determine that it was not vaccine-associated polio? No. We just had a meeting, and we just decided not to classify it. And the government attorneys were present. And that's in a deposition. That's one case. There are several others that have gone unreported. There were hundreds of cases following the introduction of the vaccine that we know of. The 9 to 10 cases a year typically represent the reporting by virtue of litigation. I've seen cases. I had a case in California that was never reported. Was it initially as a DTP case? Yes, I think there are more. I think there are a lot more polioencephalitis cases out there, probably seizures as a result of that, which have never been reported. Remember now, for 30 years, the population of this country has been receiving a vaccine that reverts to essentially wild type 3 polio within 2 or 3 days of administration. Historically, prior to the introduction of the vaccine, wild polio resulted in 20% of the cases in polioencephalitis. So I think there's a lot that is out there that we don't see and it's not reported, and you don't have an agency that's in charge of this that has any desire to report the cases. The final aside, I was during one of these lawsuits, I was in the NIH laboratory, and a phone call came in. Two NIH doctors were there. One answered it. Some physician was calling in to inquire about the rabies vaccine, which is another vaccine that can spread from the animal to the humans. And the question was to them, can the live rabies vaccine spread from animals to humans? And the doctor answered the phone. He said, just a minute, I've got to consult. And the two of them, and, you know, the doctor repeated the question out in the open. The two of them just shrugged their shoulders. Nope, never heard of it. You know, and that was the end of that inquiry to NIH. You know, it took some doctor somewhere out in the United States a long time to find the phone number to call and get into the laboratory to ask that question, and these two yo-yos just shrugged it off and said no. And so somebody out there probably died of rabies as a result, and NIH is just like, I don't care. Reminds me of something I was told as a young engineer as we started an engineering school. One of our professors came to us and said, you know, doctors can bury their mistakes. You're an engineer. You build a bridge that doesn't work, they're going to know who did it. And I guess we need, what I'm saying is we just need more responsibility at the top in the government.
Thank you.
This concludes this message. Please fast forward the remaining portion of this tape to the end to re-cue Site A for your next listening.